This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. For the past 8 months, data reporter Sunduja Rangarajan has been reporting on an issue that affects thousands of people, including her own family.
Vinod, has she slept?
Yeah.
After my husband Vinod and I put our daughter to sleep, we've gotten into this routine. Okay, let's go down and... Are you ready?
Okay.
We go down to our drawing room, open up our laptops...
Okay, sit down next to me.
Okay.
And get to work. Because we've been trying to immigrate to Canada.
Express entry... Okay.
We have like a job after our daughter goes to sleep, which is like just immigration-related paperwork.
Sunduja, I gotta say, I was really surprised the first time you told me you were thinking about leaving the U.S. I've known you for years. The two of us used to work together here at Reveal. Now you're a reporter at Mother Jones. You have a great career, and it just seems like, well, it seems like you built a life in this country.
I have, and so has my husband, Vinod. We are originally from India, but we've lived here in the U.S. for years. Our daughter was born here. Vinod also has a great job here. He's an executive at a tech company. But our future still feels really unstable. And our immigration status is tied to our jobs. And Vinod is on this work visa called H-1B.
In basic terms, what's an H-1B?
Well, Al, they're for pretty high-skilled people. Lots of computer programmers are on them. Employers apply on your behalf, and you need to have a minimum of a bachelor's degree. These visas are really popular among Indian immigrants. Around 70% of people on H-1Bs are Indian. And these visas are temporary, but they get renewed a lot.
You say a lot. I mean, how much is that?
Two-thirds of H-1Bs approved in the last fiscal year were actually renewals. Vinod's been on H-1Bs for years without any problems. But when he was getting ready to renew his visa this year, a lawyer told us there's a chance it could get denied.
They're asking that we file for the renewal earlier than usual.
Under the Trump administration, there's been this surge in the number of H-1B visas that are getting denied. Like in 2015, when Obama was in office, only 4% of these visas were denied. This year, that figure quadrupled. 16% of applicants are getting turned down. And this really fascinates me. Because H-1Bs are one of the most popular visas in the U.S., and all kinds of white-collar workers use them.
Companies are moving offices to other countries because our immigration rules prevent them from retaining highly skilled and even, if I might, totally brilliant people. We discriminate against genius. We discriminate against brilliance. We won't anymore.
That's Trump earlier this year, discussing what he calls merit-based immigration. Basically, he wants elite immigrants with lots of skills. But his administration's cracking down on the visa. A lot of those people need to immigrate here. So I wanted to know whose visas are getting denied, why are they getting denied, and are all of these denials even legitimate? That's what I wanted to find out.
We've been going deep on immigration for more than a year now. We've investigated the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy and family separation. We broke stories about how military contractors house kids in abandoned office buildings after they were separated from their parents. On today's show, though, we're going to take a different look at immigration. Instead of focusing on our southern border, we're going to investigate visas and citizenship, legal immigration processes that, we'll show, are no longer working the way they're supposed to.
You know, Al, a lot of these immigrants feel like they've followed the rules and done everything right. There's a guy I met who's a really good example of this. We're calling him Samir.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Come on in.
Samir's not his real name. He's afraid his immigration status might be affected if he speaks out publicly. My producer, Teresa, and I went to meet him at his apartment in suburban Dallas. He lives there with his wife and his 5-year-old son, who, by the way, was very cutely obsessed with our recorder.
I know, it's cool, right? How old are you?
Beep, beep.
Samir moved to the United States in 2006. He came here for grad school, he got a master's in environmental engineering, and then he landed a job at this Fortune 500 health insurance company, which is a household name, United Healthcare. One of his jobs was to streamline the way the company processed claims.
Our claims process, if you had a medical claim, it used to take almost 3 to 4 months to get it cleared. And then we dropped down that time to almost a month and a half. But there were times I worked like 70, 80 hours a week because we wanted, you know, people to get cured. They need to get the treatment. I put my soul in there.
And you received an H-1B visa.
My whole life was with United Healthcare.
He was doing really well at his job. And he also started falling in love with this country.
I never used to celebrate Christmas back home in India. But I did go to church here for the first time, just to see how they celebrate. This country is built on immigrants, right? And I wanted to feel that.
So when Samir's first H-1B ran out, United Healthcare applied to renew it. And in 2014, he was approved. This is kind of how it went for Samir. His visa would run out, get renewed, run out, get renewed. Then he decided, okay, I want to stay in the United States for good. I really like it here.
And then they filed for my green card.
United Healthcare sponsored him, and the U.S. government said he's qualified for one. Samir has actually been waiting for a green card for a couple of years now. The U.S. caps how many green cards it issues per country per year. And there are so many Indian people immigrating here that for us, there's a really long wait.
So at this point, it sounds like Samir's had a pretty typical H-1B experience.
Yeah. He's been in the U.S. for 10 years at this point. He and his wife started building a real life here. They had a son, and they bought their first house. Samir says he spent years saving up for the down payment. It's a very beautiful big house in the suburbs of Dallas. And Samir was really in love with it.
I choose each and every single item for that house, the brick selection or everything. We picked up the land. We went to each and every process, go to the design center. We put our hearts in it.
Samir and his family thought they were going to live here for the rest of their lives. That was in 2017. Trump's first year in office.
So breaking news, President Trump signing an executive order in Wisconsin not long ago titled Buy American, Hire American.
President Trump today ordering federal agencies to look at tightening the H-1B visa program.
So in 2017, Trump signed the executive order Buy American, Hire American, which urged federal agencies to overhaul H-1Bs.
Yeah. This is where the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services enters the story. Most people know it by USCIS. They're the agency that processes green cards, citizenship applications, and visas like the H-1B. Around this time, USCIS starts releasing a series of memos, basically directing its officials to approach H-1Bs a lot more skeptically. Officials are told to look at each visa application as if it's a brand new case, even if the person has been renewed many times before. And they're also told to really question an applicant's credentials. So this means that if you're an immigrant, one of the questions these memos are trying to get at is, does your job really need you? For Samir, well, it looks like his job really needs him. He's been at United Healthcare for 7 years. He keeps getting raises, bonuses, and then in 2018, he gets moved to a subsidiary. a sister company within United Health Group, doing the same kind of work. And they filed his H-1B again, and this time there was trouble.
They said, okay, my H-1 was denied.
Samir tried not to panic. He says his employer told him they would refile his application. Then, one morning at about 8:30...
There was a call, there was a meeting about a project, and I was giving some inputs on everything, everything went fine. At 9 o'clock, they scheduled another one-on-one meeting with me, the HR, and the director.
In that meeting, they told Samir that they were terminating him.
I wasn't even able to, talk or do anything, and my life just stopped.
United Health Group wouldn't talk to us about Samir's case. They did say that when an employee's H-1B visa is denied, they're required by law to terminate them. They could have appealed USCIS's decision, but they didn't.
I asked my manager, like, guys, I know you're terminating, but are you giving me like a 2 weeks notice or something? And then they said, no. That's again, my heart stopped again. And I asked them, okay, I've been working here for 8 years. Are you sending me out at least with some severance package or anything? No. My heart stopped again.
Sanduja, what did this mean for Samir's immigration status?
Al, his status was tied to his job. So without his H-1B, his family would be forced to move back to India.
I mean, even right now, my brain is freezed. That day was tough, really tough.
What did USCIS tell Samir about why his application was denied?
Well, I reviewed his denial. The agency pointed to Samir's education and said his master's degree wasn't 100% related to his job. So they decided he wasn't qualified.
Come on, a lot of people study one thing in school and go on to do something totally different.
Exactly. He also had years of experience doing this job, which the H-1B visa is supposed to take into account. And when you look at Samir's case, he doesn't line up with the kind of person Trump says he's cracking down on. This is Trump, right after signing his Buy American, Hire American executive order.
Right now, widespread abuse in our immigration system is allowing American workers of all backgrounds to be replaced by workers brought in from other countries to fill the same job for sometimes less pay. This will stop.
It's true that with H-1Bs, there are plenty of people who haven't followed the rules. Companies have abused the program and used it to bring in low-paid foreign workers. H-1Bs do need to be reformed. But Samir doesn't fit into that category. He was doing highly skilled work at a major company. I was curious to know how many other highly skilled people were getting denied too. So I started calling immigration attorneys all over the country.
So I made a list of my top examples.
Sandra Feist is an immigration attorney based in Minneapolis. She says officials are questioning whether some of her clients are qualified to do their jobs, even when their qualifications are pretty obvious.
I have two cases right now for mechanical engineers requesting additional evidence that the mechanical engineering degree earned in the United States is relevant to the mechanical engineering job. Apparently, the connection between those two is just not clear.
Then there are clients who are getting denied for being too qualified. For example, I came across this pathologist with a stack of degrees, including a master's degree in veterinary pathology, a doctor of veterinary medicine, and a PhD in pathology. A Fortune 500 pharmaceutical company wanted to hire him as an associate director of pathology, but that application was denied. USCIS said his job could be done by someone without a college degree.
Wait, I don't know anybody who learned about pathology in high school.
Me neither. The agency's also denied architects, engineers, all on the grounds that you don't need a bachelor's degree to do those jobs. Attorneys like Sandra find this so frustrating.
We don't know what the rules are anymore to the game.
A lot of Sandra's clients are Indian immigrants. They've worked for years on temporary visas while they wait in that long green card line. Now, instead of getting their residency, Sandra says some of them might be forced to move back to India. She remembers this one client. When USCIS denied her H-1B, she'd been living in the U.S. for over a decade.
Like, she looked at me across the table and she said, I just feel like garbage. I feel like the government just thinks I'm garbage. It was really sad.
Sandra says that client sued the federal government over her H-1B denial. And when she did, this funny thing happened. Before a judge even looked at the case, USCIS just reversed its decision and approved the visa.
So did they just turn around and say they made the wrong decision here?
Well, there are lots of reasons people settle in court. The only way to really know what's going on here is to track down as many cases as possible, review them all yourself, and talk to all the attorneys, which is what I did. Over the last few months, I built this database, which several different legal experts tell me is the most comprehensive one they've heard of. The first thing I found is that the Trump administration is getting sued a lot more over this. And remember, it's employers who apply for H-1Bs on behalf of their employees. So companies are really sticking their necks out there by suing the federal government over this. There may be more cases out there, but from what I found, before Trump took office, USCIS was sued about 10 times a year over H-1B denials. But in the last 2 years, they've been sued almost 90 times. And in over a third of those lawsuits, USCIS did the same thing they did with Sandra's client. They reversed their decision and approved those H-1Bs before a judge could rule in the case.
Other than these lawsuits, do we have any other window into what's going on with H-1Bs?
Yes, we do. USCIS has its own appeals process. I looked at those cases too, and I found that USCIS's own appeals office is overturning H-1B denials at a record rate. In the past, it overturned less than 3% of its decisions, but in the last 2 years, the agency has been overturning 14% of its cases. That's more than five times as many.
So what are we supposed to make of all this?
Well, I tried to talk to USCIS about wrongful denials. Agency spokespeople say they won't comment on pending litigation, and they told me they adjudicate all applications fairly. But according to the legal experts I talked to, this shift in the agency's H-1B policies, it might be unlawful. They say when USCIS drastically changes the rules around a visa, it's supposed to allow for public comments and go through this formal rulemaking procedure. And in this case, the agency didn't do any of that. These changes have thrown a lot of people's lives into chaos, particularly people who've lived on H-1Bs in this country for so many years. That's what happened to Samir.
So I've decided, okay, man, I have to sell my house.
Samir and his wife sold the house?
They didn't have a choice. They thought they were going back to India.
I think in the past 10 years since we were married, that was the first time my wife saw tears in my eyes.
Samir and his family moved into a smaller apartment about 5 minutes away. He says they tried to make the move seem like this big adventure to their son.
We didn't want to tell him that we were going through this pain. No father or parents would like to let their kids know that they're going through a hard time.
And then this confusing thing happened. Samir scrambled to find another job. His new employer applied for an H-1B on his behalf. And strangely, it got approved.
Wait, was there anything different about this application?
There were some minor differences, but really, he's the same guy with the same qualifications, with the same amount of experience for a similar job.
This just seems really inconsistent. Am I missing something?
No, Al. Inconsistent is a really good way of describing it. I came across several cases where it's not clear why USCIS is ruling one way or the other. And for Samir, it meant that all of this, selling his house, turned out to be for nothing.
This?
Nah.
Yeah. Stone Hollow. Oh, I missed it.
Yeah, this
okay,
one.
Maybe this one?
Yeah, this one.
Ooh, there's a fountain in this one.
Oh, yeah.
When my producer Teresa and I went to Dallas, we visited Samir's dream house.
The house.
Which one?
The white one.
Wow.
It was clearly more than just a house for him.
Do you come here often? Every once in a
while? I did. I used to. After I sold my house, I came in at least like 20, 30 times.
After he sold it, he kept driving by. just to look at it. He used to visit once a day, then once a week. He tries not to anymore.
Sanduja, did reporting on this make you think about your family's situation differently?
You know, it just feels like the game keeps changing and it's kind of rigged against us. My family is also dependent on H-1Bs, and we also thought we might have to move back to India. Lawyers told us that my husband Vinod's H-1B could be denied, but it actually got renewed recently.
That is a huge relief.
It is, but it's also only good for 3 years, so it doesn't change this constant limbo that we're in. We're still thinking of moving to Canada. Or, if we have to...
Well, it is what it is. If nothing, we can always go back to India.
I don't want to. Vinod and I talk about leaving the United States pretty much all the time. He's tired of the uncertainty. One of my friends has already left. One of his closest friends is planning to leave too.
This just made me realize that we just gave our youth to this country. Yeah. And so I just feel like it's a betrayal of some sort, you know. We worked here, we contributed here.
I've invested so much of my life here. And I want to fight it out and stay. But I'm just not sure I'll be able to.
Sanduja, my friend, thank you so much for that story.
Thank you, Al.
Sanduja Ragarajan is a reporter with Mother Jones. That story was produced by Teresa Katsarilis. While many people are getting their H-1Bs denied, there's another type of visa some immigrants aren't even getting a chance to apply for. That's coming up on Reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Our next story looks at a different kind of visa. One that's as much for immigrants as it is for police officers. It's called a U visa. Undocumented immigrants are often afraid to report crimes to police, afraid that by calling 911, immigration authorities could get involved and possibly deport them. To fix this, Congress created the U visa. The goal is to build trust between police and victims of violent crime. Police can say, hey, if you cooperate with us, if you help us with our investigation, we'll help you. You'll be able to apply for the U visa. It gives you status and protects you from deportation. But Reveal immigration reporter Laura Morell found that many police departments aren't using the U visa the way it was intended. Laura takes the story from here.
Natalie Alcantara lived a pretty normal life in Honduras. She was good at math, went to college, and majored in business administration.
Después entré a la universidad porque quería superarme para ayudar a mis padres.
Natalie says she wanted to go to college to help her parents. After graduating, she got a job as an accountant. Then she met someone, bought a house, and had a son. But her family's quiet life ended in the spring of 2014.
Empezaron las amenazas por teléfono hacia mi persona y hacia la vida de mi hijo.
She says gang members started calling, threatening her. In Honduras, gangs often force residents to pay a monthly fee, called La Renta, on their homes and businesses. Suddenly, they demanded half of Natalie's paycheck. If not, they told her, they'd kill her son. And that's why she immigrated, to escape these threats.
Y para poder estar a salvo con mi hijo.
And to protect her son. When they arrived in Miami, Natalie and her partner had no visa, no status. Then, one night in November 2014.
Police are searching this afternoon for two armed women who broke into a home and terrorized a family inside. They even threatened to kill a toddler and an infant during this robbery.
Natalie, her partner, their toddler son, and new baby were sleeping in a small room they rented in Miami when suddenly Natalie woke up. Inside the room, she saw two shadowy figures. One of them had a gun, the other had a knife. It was dark, hard to see. Natalie says she panicked when she saw the knife. The two intruders started yelling, demanding the family's money and valuables. If you don't give us your money, they told her, we'll kill your kids. Then one of the robbers turned to the crib where Natalie's three-month-old daughter was sleeping.
La apuntaron directamente a la niña.
The woman pointed a gun at the baby. Natalie jumped out of bed. She grabbed about $300 from a wallet, pretty much all the family savings. The women also took Natalie and her partner's cell phones and then ran out the front door. After the robbery, Natalie tells me she picked up her daughter from the crib and held her two children close. From a roommate's phone, she called the police.
De repente llegaron como más patrullas. Llegaron como 10, 11 patrullas.
Minutes later, Natalie says 10 or 11 police cars showed up outside, and they blocked off the house with crime scene tape. Natalie could hear a helicopter circling overhead. TV crews started to show up.
Crime scene investigators came out here just a short time ago. They were taking pictures in the grass behind this home. And at this point, the investigation continues. Detectives really want to find these women.
In the months after the robbery, Natalie focused on finding the women who terrorized her family. She tells me she helped police any way she could. She answered their questions and checked in every so often to see how the investigation was going. In total, Natalie says she met with officers from the City of Miami Police Department three or four times. Investigators came by the house and showed her and her partner dozens of mugshots of potential suspects. Natalie thought she got a good look at the women's faces that night.
Yo no pude identificar a nadie.
But she couldn't make a positive ID. Around the same time, Natalie started feeling the effects of the robbery. She couldn't sleep, and she began noticing changes in her 18-month-old son. He was just starting to say his first words.
Decía agua, decía mamá, decía papá, decía...
Like water, mama, papa.
Palabras, pues. Y ya después de todo eso que le pasó, ya no podía hablar. No hablaba nada.
But she says after the break-in, he just stopped talking. For about a year, he barely said a word. And whenever he saw strangers in dark clothes, he'd burst into tears. A few months after the robbery, Natalie found out about the U visa. That's when she connected with Catholic Legal Services and immigration attorney Maya Ibarz. Maya has helped lots of immigrants apply for their U visas.
Unfortunately, we've had a lot of problems with City of Miami Police in agreeing to certify.
A lot is required from victims like Natalie to apply for the U visa. Not so much for police, though. Basically, they have to sign a form certifying two things. One, that the applicant was a victim of a violent crime. And two, that they were helpful to investigators. That's it. Almost a year after the crime, Maya says they got a letter in the mail.
After careful review, it has been determined that the Miami Police Department will not be certifying this application.
The letter's one page long and nearly identical to ones I've seen from other victims and lawyers in Miami.
As you may notice, on the certification form, it reads as follows. And this part is in bold and in quotes. An agency's decision to provide a certification is entirely discretionary. So, yeah, basically they're telling us it's discretionary and we don't want to do it.
Natalie was first victimized by gangs in Honduras, then by robbers in Miami. And now, after fully cooperating with investigators, Maya says it's like Natalie's being victimized all over again.
Good morning, come through.
Hi.
Hi.
Just
picking up some records. Okay, go ahead. Let me just find the... I went to Miami Police Headquarters early one morning to pick up Natalie's case file.
Sure.
I'm
going to
get that to you. Thank you so much. Anybody for records?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. Both of them are McDonald's.
Okay. The report's thicker than I expect. As I sit in the lobby flipping through the case file, it's clear that Natalie helped police as much as she could. She even did her own detective work. The report confirms that she called her stolen cell phone, and a woman picked up. After Natalie told detectives about all this, they got the phone's call logs, which showed that after the robbery, Natalie's phone had been used to call a man. Detectives found that man, and he told them the call came from an ex-girlfriend. And when police ran a background check on the ex, they saw that she was wanted for trespassing, so they arrested her. But the woman denied any involvement in the robbery. On the bottom of one of the pages in the file, an officer wrote NFI, no further information, and Natalie's case was closed. I took these records back to Natalie to show her the new details I uncovered and see what she thinks. We sit at her dining room table. I hand her the report and translate it for her. I tell her she has a good memory. The report includes everything she told us. It says she was sleeping with her family when two people entered the room and pointed a gun at the baby. Nothing in the police report explains why Miami PD rejected Natalie's request. Natalie's lawyer, Maya, says she was told it's because the police were never able to make an arrest in the case. I try to explain this to Natalie.
El caso no era suficientemente fuerte para tratar de arrestarla.
Pero bien para ponerle las pistolas a mis hijos si si no era fuerte.
So my case wasn't strong enough, she asks, even though they pointed a gun at my kids. If Natalie's case wasn't strong enough, I wondered whose case is. So I filed a public records request for information on every U visa case submitted to Miami PD over the last three calendar years. The data I got back was telling. Out of 235 cases, the department only certified 27 of them, meaning Miami police rejected nearly 90% of the U visa requests that came before them. I took what I found to Miami Police Chief George Colina. He's been with the department for about 30 years and was sworn in as chief last year. He tells me the U visa is an important crime-fighting tool.
Ultimately, the idea is to protect victims of crime and have them available to us so we can utilize them, their testimony, to put a bad person in jail.
I tell the chief what I found, that his department only approves about 10% of U visa certifications.
What do you think about that? Is that a problem?
I don't know if it's a problem. It sounds like a low number.
Colina tells me he's going to look into whether his department is following proper procedures. It's clear Chief Colina wasn't aware of how many U visa cases his department turns down until I told him.
It sounds low, for sure. And so we're going to look at it a little closer.
And in terms of Natalie's case, Colina says he only has preliminary details, but thinks maybe her application was rejected because the crime wasn't solved and no arrests were made. I tell him that's not a requirement, and he suggests he'll look at her case again.
How do you plan to make sure that the approval rate improves or to make sure that you have a streamlined process for these requests coming in and for the consideration that they get?
I'm going to ask them to. So fortunately, I'm in a position here as the chief of police where I can find out, because like I said, it's on us. We need to be mindful of the people that we're here to protect, everyone. And so I'm going to have the ability to do that.
To see how Miami compares, I called police departments in cities and counties with large immigrant populations across six different states. Many of them refused to comment.
We do not have the time, nor do we wish to participate in your nationwide survey of departments across the country.
I talked to more than 100 law enforcement agencies in cities with large immigrant populations and found that nearly 1 in 4 find ways to block immigrants from applying for the U visa. Some reject victims immediately, others create their own arbitrary rules that go beyond what the federal government requires. Things like only certifying a U visa after a case has gone to trial, or if the victim has serious injuries. Some agencies told me that processing these applications takes time. What I learned is that police departments treat immigrant crime victims differently across the country, and whether or not victims can get U visa protections depends entirely on where a crime took place. But some police departments do follow the federal guidelines. Tony Flores works for one of them.
I am a sergeant inspector with the San Francisco Police Department, and it's the greatest job in the world.
Tony's been a police officer, solving domestic violence and human trafficking cases for the past 3 decades. He also travels around the country, training police departments on how to use the U visa. Over the years, Tony's noticed a certain type of officer. He can spot them right when he walks into trainings.
And you see that one person that's sitting there with their arms crossed and, you know, they don't want to be here.
Tony gets their skepticism. Back when he first heard about the U visa, he had the same questions, like one officers ask him all the time. Whether certifying the U visa means giving someone immigration status.
They go, no, you're not. What you are saying here at the moment is that this victim was a victim of a crime.
The form police sign is just one document out of several victims need for their U visa application.
So our role is crucial, but also our role is small in the big picture.
Tony says in San Francisco, he's seen how the U visa has helped fellow officers get information and do better police work. And he's seen that undocumented immigrants are more willing to come forward and report crimes. But in trainings, Tony makes sure to tell officers that the U visa is not just about trust. It's also about getting criminals off the street.
Wouldn't it be sad to know that you had a perpetrator in your grasp, in your sights, that you had the victim that was willing to cooperate with you, and then all of a sudden you said, no, I can't help you. And now the perpetrator is out there doing this to other victims. That's how I see it.
California, where Tony works, is one of just 11 states that have passed laws standardizing how police process U visa applications. But Florida doesn't have a law like this.
Hola, hola. Pasen, ¿cómo estás?
Bien, aquí estoy.
Pasen adelante.
It's been 5 years since Natalie's family was robbed at gunpoint, and they're trying to move on. They bought a small house in Miami and had a baby boy. But still, Natalie says, she has a hard time being alone.
Todavía siento que me ha afectado porque no puedo estar sola porque me da miedo.
She gets scared, and she's asked her partner to install a deadbolt on their front door. And when she's home alone, she takes an added precaution.
Bueno, eso casi lo hago siempre cuando yo estoy sola.
Natalie grabs a chair from the dining room table, pulls it across the floor, and shows me how she wedges it against the front door. The chair's flimsy, but she says at least it'll make a noise if someone tries to come in while she's sleeping. When Natalie first came to the U.S., she had an image of police that she'd gotten from watching American movies. She tells me she assumes that most crimes here got solved quickly and that police did right by victims. But this whole experience, the robbery, and then not getting her U visa signed, she says it's left a bad taste in her mouth.
Y la verdad que me he llevado un mal sabor de boca porque es igual que en todos los países.
The truth is, Natalie tells me, police are the same in every country. This lesson, it's pretty much the exact opposite of what the U visa was meant to do.
New applications for U visas dropped in 2018, for the first time in a decade. Besides the fact that many police departments are turning down applicants, some advocates think that people are afraid to apply because of the anti-immigration policies and rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration. Thanks to Reveal's Laura Morrell for that story. It was produced by Ashley Cleek. So, we've seen how immigrants are being denied visas that let them live and work in this country legally. And it turns out, people who want to pledge their loyalty to the U.S.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America.
Of the United States of America.
They're having problems too. why it's getting harder to become an American citizen. Next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The Paramount in downtown Oakland, California is one of my all-time favorite theaters. It was built in the early 30s. It's Art Deco with dramatic lighting and lots of red velvet. Even the bathrooms are classy. There's an event here that happens nearly every month. It brings out thousands of people dressed in their finery. Many are holding a document.
Welcome, welcome, new citizens.
Citizenship ceremonies like this mark the end of a long journey, one that's usually many years in the making. Reporter Monica Campbell from the public radio show The World visited one recent ceremony to understand what the citizenship process is all about and how it's becoming more difficult for people to become new citizens under the Trump administration. Monica starts us off just before the ceremony is about to begin.
Inside the theater, there are women in sequins, babies in dresses and tiny suits, and people holding flowers and bouquets. And if you stand around long enough, someone's going to ask you to take a group photo.
One, two, three.
As I make my way through the lobby into the auditorium, a man spots my microphone. He's tall, wearing an elegant suit, and holding a tiny American flag. As I get close, he leans in.
God bless America. God bless the American people, those lovely people. I'm very happy to be part of them. I'm very happy that my wife and my sons are going to be American citizens too.
His name is Yaunus Waldab. He's from Eritrea and gives a big wave to his wife and two young kids as they head to the balcony to watch. And things kick off with U.S. immigration officials on stage celebrating people from all over the world.
Well, let's hear it for our friends from China who are all here today.
Randy Ricks is an immigration officer with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. He announces all 97 countries represented by people in this auditorium. And he doesn't just do it in English. He does it in Cantonese, Spanish, Hindi, French, and you can tell he really enjoys this. He's hamming it up.
One more. Well, let's hear it for the Philippines.
Citizenship has become increasingly complicated and drawn out. For most immigrants, there's a 5-year wait just to become eligible. After that, the process used to move quickly. But since President Trump took office, the wait for citizenship has grown longer and more challenging. Eric Cohen runs the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. He remembers a time when citizenship moved far faster.
In most cases, about a 6-month wait time.
Start to finish.
Start to finish.
And now?
In some places, it goes as high as 15 and even as high as 2 years.
Now, that wait averages 10 months, but depending on where you live, it can take way longer. Eric has been working in immigration since the 80s. He calls himself a citizenship evangelist. His organization leads one of the biggest grassroots movements to get people into the citizenship process.
It's about building our democracy. And the way to have a stronger democracy is to have as many people who can participate.
But participation is at risk because people applying for citizenship today might not get through the process in time for next year's election. A professor at Colorado's Metropolitan State University estimates that a minimum of 150,000 people might miss their chance to vote in 2020. Not a trivial amount considering how tight some elections can get. And there are other concerns. Researchers at Syracuse found that lawsuits over citizenship were up by 66% last year, compared to 5 years earlier. Citizenship might also get a lot more expensive. USCIS has proposed raising the application fee to more than $1,100, an 83% hike. And they want to make it tougher for low-income applicants to get fee waivers. I wanted to talk to USCIS about all this. In a written statement, they said that citizenship applications skyrocketed under Obama and that they've hired new staff and opened new offices to keep pace. But under Obama, wait times were far shorter. I had more questions, but USCIS wouldn't grant me an interview. So, back at that citizenship ceremony, I decided to see if USCIS officials here would talk. There are actually two ceremonies today. In between them, I walk up on stage to ask some questions.
Hi. Randy Ricks.
Randy Ricks.
This is Joe Hamilton.
Oh, hello. Nice to meet you, Monica Campbell. I want to know about those wait times, but no dice. They say they're not allowed to talk, and questions have to go through the press contact.
Let Sharon field them.
But
well, Sharon's going to pass it to D.C., and D.C. is going to resend me a statement.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's where we are.
In this moment, they look like they want to talk, but they don't do it.
Nope. Yeah.
Nothing? Okay. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. People like Randy Ricks, a longtime staffer at USCIS who goes out of his way to greet new citizens in their own language, that's not who's setting the tone for USCIS these days.
Let's be really clear. We are a vetting agency first, not a benefits agency.
Ken Cuccinelli ran USCIS until November when he got a promotion. Trump named him the acting deputy director of Homeland Security, which oversees USCIS and immigration enforcement like ICE and Border Patrol. Cuccinelli has become the administration's go-to voice on immigration. He supports keeping families in detention and ending birthright citizenship. Last year, speaking to Breitbart, he likened migrants at the border to invaders who should be turned back.
Literally, you don't have to keep them, no catch and release, no nothing. You just point them back across the river and let them swim for it.
Cuccinelli helped rebrand USCIS, making it more about enforcement and vetting, which seems like overkill to immigration advocates like Eric Cohen, the lawyer from the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Eric points out that most citizenship applicants are green card holders who've been vetted before, often twice.
You're someone who's going to have your fingerprints done. It's going to go through a number of databases, including the FBI, DHS, and all sorts of other databases to check to see what sorts of ineligibility issues you might have. So you go through quite a rigorous process.
Eric and other lawyers say they're seeing people's cases re-vetted at extreme levels. In one example, he says an official checked for marriage fraud by asking to see an applicant's house key. They wanted to make sure it was identical to their spouse's.
In one case, they had a kid together. Now, I mean, who commits marriage fraud being vetted twice and have a kid together? You don't make that stuff up.
USCIS officials say they're overwhelmed with applications, and it's true. There's been a surge, but this isn't new. Applications for citizenship have jumped before, usually around elections. Previous administrations typically added muscle to process applications more quickly and bring wait times back to normal. That's not happening today. Instead, Cuccinelli moves staff away from the problem, specifically to the U.S.-Mexico border, where hundreds of officers were sent this year.
When we have a pull on our resources, like we have with the southern border crisis, it does inhibit our ability to do other things.
My dear fellow Americans, it is with great pride that I welcome you into the American family.
Back at the citizenship ceremony, on a large screen, there's a recorded message from President Trump.
This country is now your country.
This country is now your country. And what that means for lots of people here is security. Many in this auditorium are trading green cards for citizenship, and there's a lot of reason to do that. The Trump administration is making green card holders more vulnerable. Attorney General William Barr made it easier to deport legal permanent residents who commit certain crimes. It's security, one man I met here is grateful for.
My name is Alejandro Morales. I'm from Mexico City, and I feel great.
Alejandro has lived in the U.S. for 30 years. He's an entrepreneur. He ran a jewelry store here and businesses in Mexico. He says his daughter convinced him to get citizenship because she worried about him traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico on a green card.
We have had a lot of troubles in this country about immigration, you know? Yeah. So this is very important, not just for me, for the family. My daughter, my son, my granddaughters.
For Alejandro, citizenship means the freedom to travel in and out of the U.S. with less worry and less anxiety for his family. And family is a big deal at this ceremony. It's not just the people taking the oath today who will become new citizens. Their kids looking down from the balcony will get citizenship too, automatically, as long as they're under 18. That's been the law since 2000.
And now all of you should be standing. It looks as though you all are. And now you will represent one country.
As the ceremony winds down, everyone gets on their feet. They raise their right hand and recite the Oath of Allegiance.
I hereby declare on oath
that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity.
It goes on for 2 solid minutes. The audience swears to support and defend the Constitution, to bear true faith and allegiance, to bear arms and defend the U.S., and to do so freely, without any mental reservation.
Or purpose of evasion.
It's taken years for many of the people here to get to this point, and it's a process that is getting longer and harder for those applying today.
Congratulations, new citizens.
Thanks to Monica Campbell for that story. She's a reporter at the public radio show The World, and today, those new citizens are going to play us out.
The dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight.
Today's show was edited by Brett Myers. It was produced by Teresa Katsarilis, Ashley Cleek, and Monica Campbell. Thanks to our partners at Mother Jones and the public radio show The World. For our story about H-1B visas, we had a lot of help putting together that national database. We especially want to thank Stephen Yale Lair and Hoon Lee at Cornell Law School, Jill Family at Widener University, the staff at the UC Berkeley and San Francisco Law Libraries, and also thanks to Sean Musgrave. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Amy Mustafa and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reuven David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.